Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And before we start our conversation today, we're going to spend a bit of time just flagging up that what we're going to be talking about today is the painful topic of baby loss and miscarriage. We want to stay right at the top. That might not be suitable for everyone to listen to, particularly for those for whom it might have affected you or those you love personally. So if that's you, please feel free to skip this episode and we'll see you next week. But also we want to say that we're very aware that this is a conversation between two men about an issue which, you know, primarily but not exclusively does affect women. And so we want to say that we're aware of that, and we spent a lot of time thinking and reading stories from women and others. On top of that, miscarriage and baby loss, while primarily something experienced by women, is not solely experienced by women. And actually, every pregnancy inevitably begins with a man and a woman together. Every child has a father. And so men are involved, like whether they like it or not. There's often, you know, men are involved trying to support their partners who have gone through baby loss and miscarriage. But also, as we'll discuss later on, themselves often very directly affected by the tragedy. And I think we both feel quite strongly, don't we, that actually this is not an issue which should be kind of hived off as a quote unquote women's issue. But because it affects everyone, men and women alike, it should be discussed across the kind of social space and not kind of relegated to as a secondary concern only for women to think about.
Absolutely. So, I mean, as a paediatrician who cared a lot for many dying babies, the issue about stillbirth, neonatal death is something that's been very close to me professionally. But it is interesting how this, what's actually triggered us to take this, to do this podcast is the fact that it just last week, it was Baby Loss Awareness Week, which is an annual event organized by a coalition of organizations who are involved, particularly SANDS, which is the Stillbirth and Neonatal Death Society. And they try to raise the profile of miscarriage and stillbirth and raise awareness of it. And, you know, this is something that I think is a really important topic. I mean, I think they haven't done incredibly well in getting much traction in the public arena. I don't know. Were you aware of this before we started talking about it?
Unfortunately not, no, I'm afraid to say. I mean, I've come across some of the charities involved before. You kind of sometimes hear about them and their fundraising efforts. But no, I'm afraid to say Baby Loss Awareness Week totally passed me by, and I suspect probably quite a lot of other people, unfortunately, because I think it's a really creditable effort to say, actually, you know, this is an issue which has been in the shadows of our society for a long time, and it's long past time that we brought it out into the light, as it were.
Yes. So I think one way in, which is just to see, read some of the stories on the Baby Loss Awareness Week. We'll put in a link in the show notes, and we recommend that you go and visit the website and just read some of the stories there, which are quite moving and striking.
Yeah, that's right. We wanted to share a handful of those just to kind of set the tone. The one that jumped out at me when I was reading some of these stories was from a woman, a mother called Elsie. And she is 18, and she experienced two miscarriages, a baby called Lyra, who died at 11 weeks, and another son called Lionel, who died at 4 weeks. And she was just 16 years old at the time. And she wrote this. The staff at the hospital were really lovely at the early pregnancy unit. The midwife, when I found out that I lost, she was even crying. But I found that there's no support after you leave hospital. I tried lots of different places and people. Some were helpful and some were not. A lot of places don't feel right for me because everyone was a lot older than me, so I didn't relate it with their lives. People always blame it on me due to my age, but it's not my fault, and I know that. People just care about my age and not my grief. People say, at least you were young, or at least you will live better. Having a miscarriage and a chemical pregnancy is really difficult, especially at my age, because no one understands or can relate. A lot of people were like, you've got the future, it doesn't matter. It can feel like sometimes with older people, they're like, oh my God, we're here for you, but that support isn't there for a young person. I'm fed up with at least this, at least that. No mum ever deserves that. Every mama deserves to have their grief accepted. Their babies don't deserve to be forgotten about. Their babies are valid. They existed. They are real and they happened. They existed if only for a minute or an hour or a week or a month or even half a year. Those babies lived, and that deserves to be known.
It's a very passionate and moving cry, isn't it? And it's striking that, you know, these are very early miscarriages, and yet for this lady, Elsie, these are two babies, they've got names, and she wants for society to recognise that these babies existed and were significant.
Yeah, and that there's something, there's almost a kind of re-traumatisation, you know, you have the initial shock and grief of the miscarriage, but then when that's not acknowledged in the way that you believe it should be, when that's dismissed, you know, people say, well, you're young, you'll get pregnant again. It actually, in some sense, she appears to be saying is a kind of a second grief, a re-traumatization, which is a really important, I think, for those of us, you know, talking to people who've experienced miscarriage to remember.
That's right. I mean, there's another story on the Baby Loss Awareness Week website, Jo's story. And she says, between 2010 to 2018, I lost 15 babies. We worked with fantastic medical professionals over the years, but no one could ever find out why we were losing each pregnancy. It was the not knowing that was one of the most difficult aspects of the losses. I went into every pregnancy with crippling anxiety that things would go wrong. Each pregnancy, I set little milestones to try and focus on the immediate and not fixate on how unlikely it was that I would make it to full term. Reading stories from other people who are going through similar losses helped me to feel a little less alone, which is why I want to share my story. Eventually, we now have two beautiful rainbow babies and will feel eternally grateful, but the grief and heartbreak of those 15 losses have fundamentally changed me forever.
Hmm. I mean, I don't know how it feels to you, but I'm kind of almost in awe of people like Jo who can, you know, go through 15 miscarriages before they manage to successfully kind of carry a child to term, and the kind of determination and perseverance and the drive to keep on living with that grief and that suffering is, yeah, it's absolutely astonishing, remarkable to me.
And I am aware that, you know, not all these stories end happily, and there are many examples, mm-hmm. tragically, of couples who desperately want to have a child, have a recurrent series of miscarriages, and in the end feel that they're never going to be parents. And I think that this is something we really need to be sensitive about, those of us who are parents and have young babies, you know. And I think it's a continuing problem in the church, isn't it, that often local churches are very child-centered. There's a lot of celebration about babies and families, and we just tend to forget the people sitting there who have had this continual story of miscarriage and of what they see as losing babies.
Yeah, and we mentioned this, didn't we, when we've in previous podcasts around infertility and reproductive treatment, that for whatever reason, the evangelical church has kind of gone down a bit of a cul-de-sac in kind of idolizing the kind of nuclear family and the kind of squeaky clean mum, dad, 2.2 children, Labrador and semi-detached home. And and that's painful enough for someone, for a couple perhaps who have been trying to conceive for years without success, but even more kind of hard to sit in the pews as someone who might have had a series of miscarriages, to spend so much time in an institution that is so geared around, as you say, the kind of happy bouncing babies on their mother's knees.
Yeah. So I think one of the interesting things is to take a kind of biographical historical view of miscarriage, because of course this reality has been around since the dawn of time. Statistics actually are very hard to come by, and it's very difficult to get very reliable statistics, but a reasonably reputable statistic is that 1 in 5 of pregnancies will end in a miscarriage, and 1 in 6 of people who know they are pregnant. So this is common, and yet until now, until very recently, it was largely suppressed, wasn't it, and just put aside as something that was intensely private and not to be discussed.
Yeah, definitely. You definitely got the sense, kind of growing up, at least I did in the 90s and the noughties, that you were aware that this was a thing that sometimes happened, but you only really came across it very removed. You know, I never had people tell me, you know, oh, my mum and dad had a miscarriage, or even I had a miscarriage. I'm talking to some older generations. It was seen as, you know, well, that's not real bereavement. That's not real grief. It's upsetting, sure, but, you know, you'll get over it and get pregnant next time and life kind of moves on. And it wasn't really, it felt like the language around it didn't really acknowledge or recognize what impact it might have been having on these mothers.
Yeah, so I think there was both a great deal of insensitivity, including, I think, especially from male medical professionals, or medical professionals in general, I think both male and female, probably didn't have the kind of understanding of the emotional significance which we now have. But I think also it was just regarded as intensely private. I mean, my parents, we have four children. They had four children. I was one of four. There was a big gap between number three and number four. And it was only when I was, you know, probably in my late teens that I worked out, or from hints they dropped, that my mother had had a miscarriage after the third pregnancy, between the third and the fourth child, and that this had been a very painful and difficult experience, but it was entirely hushed up and not talked about. And I think they would have felt it was entirely inappropriate to talk about it in public.
Yeah. And on one level, I think it's important to recognise that's an understandable response. And maybe for a lot of women, the sense of privacy wasn't because, you know, society was stigmatising and silencing them, but actually because they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't find it helpful to bring in the wider networks of friends and families. You know, what could be done ultimately? It was an irreversible, unpredictable tragedy. And so maybe, you know, a lot of people felt, actually, this is not something I want to kind of expose my vulnerabilities to the world.
So, you know, fast forward two generations, what's your, you know, amongst young marrieds, people trying to have babies and so on, what's your perception now in your generation?
Yeah, I think it's remarkably different. I mean, I acknowledge that my kind of circle of friends and family at similar age are not in any way representative of the whole generation. And particularly, you know, the vast majority of them would be kind of practicing Christians, and potentially that shapes how people respond to miscarriage. But certainly there's much greater openness. You know, off the top of my head, I could think of 5, 6, 7 couples I know of who have experienced miscarriage, who have either kind of just outright told us, sometimes during the time, because they were looking for kind of pastoral support, for care. And more often, maybe a little after the time has passed, and it kind of is just mentioned as one of those things, you know, last year was tough for us because, you know, at this point, you know, we suffered a miscarriage. So there's certainly much, much less of a sense that this is by default a thing that it is inappropriate to talk about with other people, or a thing that is so private that it should not be shared. I'm sure there are even more people who I know who have had miscarriages who haven't told me about it. So I'm sure the numbers are even higher, but there's certainly quite a striking change in tone, I think, in that there is a sense in which both that this is not a private grief, but something that can be shared, but also actually that this is a real grief. You know, this is not just an unfortunate medical accident, but that, you know, these people are real parents of a real baby. And particularly for those of us who are Christians, you know, that child probably, you know, is with God in some sense. And, you know, maybe there are different views about this, but, you know, I think a lot of people talk about the fact that, you know, I'm not a father of two. I'm actually a father of three. You know, there's two right on earth with me, but I know there's a third son or daughter who I'll meet one day in the new creation. So that's quite a striking sense that actually this is a real valid experience of bereavement. You know, maybe not the same as losing a child who had actually been born, but certainly not something that should just be kind of swept under the rug as one of those things.
Yeah, and the statistics on mental health are really very striking. The government commissioned an independent pregnancy loss review, and a report came out in July 2023. And again, we'll link to that in the notes. But it's a very detailed review, and one of the things it discusses is the evidence of the impact of pregnancy loss on mental health. And for instance, a large recent study, 2019, 29% of women met the criteria for PTSD 1 month after early pregnancy loss. This decreased to 18% nine months after the loss. Other statistics, 41% of women reported they suffered PTSD for a time following baby loss. 36% of women reported they still were suffering with PTSD. And 50% of women reported they suffered clinical depression following baby loss.
Yeah, really, really stark figures there, aren't they, about just how incredibly significant the impact. And this is kind of tells the lie to the kind of the old way of dealing with miscarriage, because, you know, even putting aside the broader changes in society around, you know, like emotional openness and things like that, any medical event which was causing, you know, these kind of mental health impacts should have been of greater concern to the medical professionals than it was. You know, if something else was happening to women and causing 50% or whatever it was to experience PTSD, like, it would have been taken much more seriously. So I think there was a bit of a dereliction of duty there.
Yeah, and one of the interesting questions is, what's the impact on men? What's the impact on partners? And that seems to have been much less studied. But certainly there's anecdotal evidence that some men find it desperately painful and difficult to come to terms with the miscarriage. So it simply isn't true that this is something that just affects women.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, what else did you make of the pregnancy loss review? There were some interesting recommendations, wasn't there, about recognizing and acknowledging a baby loss, particularly around this idea of creating a kind of official certificate.
Yeah, so there's a very strong drive amongst many, many parents who've lost a baby early on in pregnancy to have an official recognition of the child's existence. They find it extremely painful, understandably, that it's like the world just moves on and says, yeah, well, okay, that's your private loss, but really, you know, there's no official recognition that this life ever existed. So historically, you could only get a death certificate if the child had actually shown signs of life after birth. And then there was a stillbirth certificate, which was if the child was born after 24 weeks gestation but born dead. And it's only more recently that the certification criteria have been loosened and made more applicable to early miscarriage. But the proposal interestingly, from the Pregnancy Loss Review was that it ought to be possible to, for you to have a formal official government certificate for a miscarriage at any gestational age, including the possibility of naming the baby. But also the same should apply to historic cases, so that you ought to be able to say, you know, I had a miscarriage some years ago. This has never been recognised. I would like the government to issue a formal certificate. So it's quite a radical proposal, really. But I can see what's driving it, this need to have a public recognition that there was a baby there. There was someone there.
Yeah. And there was an interesting line I was just reading from the foreword by one of the review's authors, a woman called Zoe Clark Coates, who helps run Saying Goodbye, which is one of the biggest kind of charities supporting people who've gone through baby loss. And she talks about her own experience about how her and her husband lost five children, and how the kind of injustice she feels that they don't appear on the kind of family tree, you know, that they're kind of a silence, when from her perspective, these are just as much her children as all of her other children who actually, you know, are alive today. So I can certainly understand the kind of the injustice that is felt when it's kind of they exist only in your memories. You know, maybe they don't have a grave or a site that you can visit, that, you know, there's no recognition of the significance of that life, even if it was short.
Yeah. And I think there's still a great deal of work to do. The review, a lot of the review is making recommendations for professionals. And there are repeated complaints that professionals are insensitive, that hospitals don't recognise the significance of, for instance, if a woman comes because of vaginal, you know, a pregnant woman comes to vaginal bleeding, comes to an A&E department, and an ultrasound scan is done and it shows that in fact the baby has died, then how is the woman treated in the A&E department? And I mean, you can see the challenge, can't you? You know, it's a busy, maybe it's the middle of the night, there are all kinds of things going on. The Pregnancy Loss Review is arguing that hospitals should have special procedures for this eventuality. They should have separate rooms, you know, that the woman should be treated with sensitivity and offered support and emotional care and so on. I think there's a lot to do in terms of raising the awareness just amongst health professionals, let alone amongst the general public.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about a brand new resource that we're offering this month from NT Wright. Ask NT Wright Anything, the Essential Collection. It's a compilation of Tom's most asked questions, like, should we pray to God the Father or Jesus? Should Christians improve the world if it's all being renewed anyway? Or how can I be a Christian and make sense of modern questions that defy God's existence? This resource is our thank you gift when you support Premier Insight this month. Your generosity equips believers across the country with biblical wisdom in a confused world. Go now to premierinsight.org/donate to request your copy. That's premierinsight.org/donate. Now let's get back to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Definitely. I mean, what kind of training did you have as a doctor on how to handle miscarriage or pregnancy loss? Admittedly, some time ago now, but...
Yes, indeed. Well, the short answer was none at all, I think. I mean, you know, it was known as a phenomenon, but from a medical point of view, all you're worried about is the complications. So, you know, you're worried about, yes, infection, hemorrhage, you know, what was called retained products of conception, where you would then need to have a surgical procedure. But, you know, it's a typical medical approach. You know, all you're thinking about is what could go wrong medically and how to fix it. You're not really thinking about you know, how is this person responding emotionally to this loss? And it's one of the problems in medicine is it inevitably, because you would see this in a very, you know, particularly if you were working in gynecology, this is completely routine. You would be seeing this very, very commonly. Inevitably, a kind of callousness, a kind of hardness, it can easily happen. And particularly, I think male doctors can be incredibly insensitive.
I mean, this probably is an issue in a lot of medicine, but, you know, I'd even recognise it in some aspects of my work as a journalist, is that sometimes the person I'm speaking to, or what I'm at, the event I'm asking questions about, is the worst thing that's ever happened to them. Whereas for me, this might be the 10th or the 30th or the 100th time I've covered such a story. And so you inevitably become desensitised to it. And I guess there's a challenge for every doctor, but particularly for those working in this field, to say, you know, miscarriage is not new or surprising to you, but it's probably the most upsetting thing that might have ever happened to this young woman in her late 20s or early 30s.
That's right. Interestingly, and I was quite struck by, there's a bit in the review where it talks about, actually, there are lots of health professionals themselves who've had miscarriages, you know, lots of midwives, lots of nurses, lots of women. And then saying, well, then how are they coping with this, you know, and how are they responding? And I think, again, there's a kind of psychological mechanism which health professionals do, which is a kind of compartmentalization. You know, you put your own personal feelings, reactions, emotions onto one side. You say, this is a clinical problem. How can I respond to this patient? And sometimes that's not always healthy. Sometimes recognizing and being honest about, this is something that impacts me too, and I understand what it's like, you know, is helpful.
Hmm. And how do you feel kind of confident that NHS kind of gynecology services are moving in the right direction, from the kind of trajectory of the 1970s when you were training through to the present day? Does it feel like, you know, If a woman who experiences a miscarriage today in 2023 is going to have a significantly better experience than they might have done 20 or 30 years earlier?
I think yes, in theory. So I think, for instance, medical students these days get a lot of input and training on sensitive communication, and including using actors, male and female, as surrogate patients. And my experience of using actors for communication training is they're remarkably, you know, professional actors are remarkably good at taking on these roles. And it's a very good way of training students and junior doctors. So I think I've no doubt that the training is already there, and that following this kind of baby loss, pregnancy loss review, it will become even more. There'll be even more training. Interestingly, one of the health professionals which have been recognised as very important are the ultrasonographers who do the antenatal scan, because it's often the ultrasonographer who's the first person, and they may not be a doctor. They usually aren't. They're usually it's a separate profession, but they suddenly find themselves pitchforked into, you know, I've just done the scan, there isn't a heartbeat, what do I do now? So they are being, you know, there's a big move to make sure better training, better awareness, and all the rest. So I think it is true that there's a much greater awareness now of the importance of training. You've got to set that against the realities of what the NHS is currently struggling with, which is, yeah, you know, it's hard enough keeping people alive and making sure they get essential life saving treatment, let alone providing, you know, really sensitive, thoughtful, compassionate care,
yeah,
for someone who, from a clinical medical point of view, this is not a life-threatening emergency.
And how do you think we should feel as believers, as Christians, about this kind of cultural shift that we've been sketching out, about the radical change in the way that we think about baby loss and miscarriage? Is this like an unmitigated good thing from our perspective?
Well, I think I would want to argue it is. Is it unmitigated? Well, you know, you can see how it raises all kinds of other questions and challenges. One of the interesting questions I'd like to ask is, to what extent are church leaders, pastors, people training to be vicars and so on, to what extent are they aware of all this? Because you could certainly imagine that sitting in the congregation will be a significant number of people who've had miscarriage. I mean, have you ever heard a sermon about this? Would it be helpful to discuss this and name it? And similar to infertility, I mean, these are very important issues for very many people.
And I think it's also important to think about, how do we preach about the many Bible passages that tackle subjects around, you know, pregnancy, childbirth, stillbirth, child loss, and even, you know, mothers dying, you know, when these, let alone kind of standalone sermons, but these passages, when they come up in our preaching, in our sermon series, are preachers and church leaders giving kind of serious thought to how they will be heard by women in their congregation who might have experienced baby loss? You know, because me as a man, I'm going to hear that story about, I don't know, Rachel and Leah or something like that very differently to someone sitting next to me in the pew who has actually had real first-hand experience of baby loss.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I think there is a danger that often when people preach, particularly from the Old Testament stories, that these stories are treated almost like just parables that we can make a spiritual point about, and we sort of glide over almost the fact that these are real people with real agonies, and that there are huge pastoral implications here. Both that it would be incredibly pastorally insensitive not to recognize that, you know, that there are people here who may have been personally affected by these issues, but also plus it would be, there are opportunities for Christians really engaging with heartfelt concerns for many people.
Absolutely. You know, the example that comes to my mind is hearing preaching about the Christmas story, which you kind of become very familiar with. But I remember being in my kind of early teens when I first heard a preacher kind of really dwell on the fact that for Mary to become pregnant as an unmarried person, when she said yes to God, that was, the social consequences of that were devastating for her, and that she was opening herself up to the possibility of even kind of an honor style killing, you know, by Joseph or his family, and at best kind of social stigma and disgrace. And so it wasn't just like, oh my gosh, you know, there's a big spiritual story here about the incarnation and God, you know, coming to earth as a human being. But there's also, you have to understand the great sacrifice and cost of the people involved, and think about, you know, it's hard enough in our time for kind of single, unmarried teenage women to become pregnant and carry those children through to term. How much harder must it have been 2000 years ago in the kind of deeply patriarchal society of first century Judea? And it's actually, as you say, it's really important for us to get a holistic view of particularly the Old Testament, which feels so distant, and see these as real living, breathing human beings who would have experienced the same kind of emotions that we would have experienced and put in the same situation. I think the other thing to say, you know, whether we were talking about whether we would kind of welcome this cultural shift as believers, is for me, yes, absolutely, in the sense that it is much more sensitive to the needs of mothers and fathers, as we mentioned, experiencing baby loss, and that it recognizes their own kind of dignity and humanity that's been, you know, marred by their grief and by their bereavement. But secondarily, I think it's welcome because it seems to me to be a more authentically Christian approach to the status of the unborn child, rather than saying this is just a kind of mass growing in the woman's womb, and if it disappears, well, you know, that's unfortunate, try again next time, which is the kind of implicit theology, as you were, of how it used to be handled. I feel like unintentionally, perhaps because it's mostly been driven by secular groups, but today's kind of much more empathic and compassionate response to miscarriage actually feels like a more authentically Christian and truthful language and vocabulary to adopt around babies, which is that they are valued and precious, and they do carry a common humanity with us, and that they're not kind of accidental and random and can be discarded without a thought, but they leave behind, you know, lifelong ripples and consequences, even if they never actually manage to live beyond 12 or 18 or 24 weeks.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's interesting, you know, in the scriptures, there are many examples, well, a number of examples where an unborn child is part of the actor in the narrative, is part of the part of the drama. But of course, up until the last few decades, it was impossible to know anything about the baby in the womb. It was a kind of just utterly mysterious phenomenon. Whereas ultrasound has now completely changed the experience of pregnancy. And this ability to have really high resolution images going all the way down to a few weeks gestation. I've got an ultrasound scan I found on the internet, which shows it's a very, very early ultrasound. And there's this tiny little piece of tissue in the middle, but the parents have taken this ultrasound scan and put a great big heart around it. And it says, "We're having a baby." And it's the way that ultrasound actually allows you to see the very early pregnancy is a remarkable phenomenon. And it's just interesting how technology then changes the psychology. Mm-hmm. At least it influences the psychology.
And, you know, maybe we'd go as far to say ultrasound gives us a fraction of an insight into that unborn child that God has. You know, God is not unable to discern the depths of the womb like we are, but God has always seen and known these children. And now in a sliver of the kind of the way that God sees a child, we as parents, as societies, can see and recognize these children a little bit more for who they are. And I think that can probably only be a really positive thing. But of course, it always leads on to questions about how we talk about other unborn children in society. And so next week, we're going to pick up this conversation around baby loss and the kind of cultural shifts that we've experienced and think about how that might conflict or contrast with language we talk about abortion and children who are whose pregnancies end intentionally rather than unintentionally. Again, a kind of sensitive, difficult topic, but I think tying these together gives us a kind of a fresher, deeper insight into how wider society is talking and thinking about the unborn child. So thank you very much for listening. I hope we managed to treat this with the sensitivity and seriousness that it deserves. But we're really interested in what you think and what you make of what we've been talking about. So please do get in touch, particularly if you want to push back on anything we've said or point out things that we've missed. We're really open to that. So do send us an email, molad@premier.org.uk. And there's lots about pregnancy and medical ethics on Dad's website if you'd like to read a bit more or listen to some previous podcasts or even find some videos of talks that he's done at various places on this topic. You can head over to johnwyatt.com, johnwyatt.com. But until then, we'll see you again next week, another episode. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
If your brain is at full capacity with to-dos, birthdays, dinner plans, meet Skylight Calendar. It syncs your entire family's schedule onto a sleek digital display so you focus on important things, like where you left your coffee. Right now, Skylight is offering our listeners $30 off their 15-inch calendars by going to skylightcal.com/talk. Go to skylightcal.com/talk for $30 off your 15-inch calendar. That's skylightcal.com/talk.
Lo sabe que ahora más que nunca buscas el precio más bajo. Por eso, cuenta con nuestra garantía de precios bajos para obtener lo que necesitas a precios competitivos para tus proyectos. Y si encuentras un artículo igual a un precio más bajo que califica, te lo igualaremos. Lowe's. Nosotros ayudamos. Tú ahorras.
Igualación de precio aplica al artículo igual con un precio actual en tiendas calificadas. Aplican términos y exclusiones. Detalles en Lowe's.com/garantía precios bajos.